coming to this lecture by Al Alcorn. When John Hardy asked me to moderate this, he said, oh, I just have to go up and introduce Al. And, like, I was sort of thinking, how am I going to introduce Al Alcorn? Like, if you guys don't know who he is already, you may be at the wrong convention. but for what it's worth, employee number 3 at Atari and the first engineer and helped create Pong, which I think most people here should be familiar with. And so Al's just going to go ahead and start out by saying a few words about Atari and Pong and, you know, the 30 years since that got rolling, and then we'll probably, I have a couple questions, and then we'll, as soon as possible, just open it up to questions from the floor, and it should be pretty fun. I'm excited.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I want to thank you guys for being here. It seems Atari and doing all that stuff was really a great part of my life, and I was very lucky to be able to do that. And that was something that I did between really 1972 and 1981, and I've done other things since then. And so I tend to forget about that, except for all the old stuff I got in the garage, bumps my wife bumps into. But I'm really thankful that you guys are here and that you guys are interested in these old stories and that old stuff. To me, it's kind of old stuff. I like doing new things, but it's fun to relive it. So here I am, and I'd like to, if you're interested, I'll bore you with some stories about the old days and how things happened. I guess one of the stories I think you might be interested in is how it came about that I designed Pong. I grew up in San Francisco. When I was just beginning to be a teenager, we lived right in the Haight-Ashbury district. And I was always interested in electronics, and my neighbor across the street had a television repair shop. So when I was in junior high school, I was fixing television. This was vacuum tube televisions. I also took a RCA correspondence course in radio and television repair. And my senior year in high school, I actually made money running the inside guy at a TV repair shop. A typical TV repair shop in those days would have a guy who would drive the truck and was presentable and was nice to people, and he'd go out to the home and try to fix the set by putting tubes in. If that didn't work, he'd bring it in, and my job was I had to fix anything. It had to get fixed, but I didn't have to deal with the customer. I didn't have to be terribly polite. So I was the guy in the back, and I wound up, also might surprise you, I was a football jock at Lowell High School in San Francisco. All city football, played against O.J. Simpson, and I was actually all state, which is important because that's how I got into Cal Berkeley. This was during the Vietnam War, and it was really nice to get into a place like Cal because it was a hell of a lot nicer than going to Vietnam at that time. And I happened to learn a lot about electronics there. In my junior year at Cal, I got kind of tired. Cal was pretty tough, and I decided to join a thing called the Work Study Program, where you go to work in industry for 6 months, and then you go back to school for 6 months. And I put my resume out, and nobody hired me, nothing. And my mother was a secretary for an insurance company, and her boss knew the president of Ampex, and she said, I'll get you, she could get me a job. So I said, okay, do what you can. So next thing I knew, I'm invited down to Redwood City. I interviewed some idiot in HR. He sends me down to Sunnyvale, where I met this group called Videophile, managed by a gentleman named Kurt Wallace, who's still a dear friend. And they were doing video filing and retrieval using videotape and project. It was a big project. But in that team I was hired into was Nolan Bushnell, Ted Dabney, Steve Mayer, Larry Emmons, what eventually became the beginnings, the core of what became Atari. And there, I was an analog engineer by training, and I learned a lot about television. Many of the people there at Ampex were the people that invented videotape recording. So, and I was doing sync generators, and I was using TTL, the first digital parts that came out. I eventually graduated from Cal, got a job at Pertec Southern California. That wasn't as much fun. I wound up, came back up to the Bay Area. Got my job again at Ampex. By this time, Nolan had spun out. This was 1971, and everybody said, this is a crazy thing. Nolan has gone to work for a Nutting Associates making coin-operated machines with the television set in them. Like, oh, man, he quit a really good job at Ampex. There's a career there, and he's going to go and do, and he's working as an engineer for an amusement manufacturer. What got on with him? So I'm working at Ampex, and one day Nolan calls me up, and he and Ted Dabney, who was employee number 2 at then Syzygy, take me out to lunch. And it was basically a pitch to hire me. And I, at that time, I was 24 years old. He impresses me by he's got a Oldsmobile station wagon, and it's a company car. And the concept of, like, you can drive a car that isn't yours, and you can, like, wow, a free car. Awesome, you know, it's a station wagon, but, you know, you could move, you know, certain pinball machines and stuff in it. So they offered me $1,000 a month salary, which was less than I was making in Ampex, unfortunately. I was making $1,200 at Ampex. But Ampex was going to be less and less fun. They were having some financial troubles. And they also offered me 10% of the stock in the company, which I assume would be worthless because, I mean, in those days, people did not start companies. This was a really not a common thing to do. It was pretty stupid. But, hey, I was young, and it would be really fun to do a little startup company, see how far we could get. I would learn more about manufacturing, engineering, purchasing, marketing. Because at Ampex, as an engineer there, you just did engineering and you didn't do PC board layout. You didn't do any of this other stuff. It was all just very narrow. So this would be great. And then when Syzygy failed in a year or two, I'd go back to work at Ampex. That was the plan. So I figured, great, I took the job. Nolan then inspired me. He wanted, well, Nolan had ever designed Computer Space, of which there's a beautiful version running out there. I'm stunned to see the thing running with a vacuum tube television. The game did not do terribly well in the market. What he really wanted to do was something more complex, more elaborate, like a driving game. But he never told me that. He wanted to get me up to speed, so he described the simplest game he could think of, which became Pong, which is a ping pong game. One spot moving, two scores, and simple sounds. And he told me he was going to throw it away. I didn't know this, but he wanted me to work hard at it to get up to speed, simple. So he told me he had a contract from General Electric, and that it was a consumer product. Now, the fact that nobody from General Electric ever called or wrote a letter or came by, I was too busy building this thing, and I was actually pretty depressed because about 3 months had gone by, and I was up to like 75 ICs. The game worked pretty well, but it wasn't a consumer product. It was way too expensive for that, so it was really, I did not consider it a success. At that time, Nolan, and also, there were big arguments we had about the gameplay because just one speed wouldn't work, so I had to add the speed-up circuitry and the different angles of the ball bouncing, added those in, and the sound was something of contention. Nolan wanted me to do the roar of a crowd of thousands when the ball would go. Well, I didn't want to do that with TTL stuff. I already had too many parts in there anyway. Ted Dabney wanted me to do boos and hisses. I sure couldn't do that either. So I spent a half a day and poked around the sync generator to find tones that seemed appropriate and pulled those out, and those were the sounds of Pong. It just kind of happened that way. So at the time, we had a route. We had this little shop. We actually did have a contract from Bally to do a video game for them, a pinball machine, and something else. I was doing this video game, which is going to be a throwaway. All of a sudden, it seemed to play pretty well. So Nolan had Ted Dabney over the weekend build a very simple box for it. I went to Walgreens and bought a Panasonic black and white television for $75, turned it into a monitor. He put it in the box, put a laundromat coin mechanism on the side of it. One of our best locations was a bar called Andy Capp's on El Camino Real. We put it there next to a pinball machine, next to a Computer Space. And I remember the first day we had it there, because Nolan said, well, let's put it out there and see what it does, you see what happens. And we sat back and watched as the very first person played the machine. And this is, remember, this is a bar, a young person's bar in San Mateo, or Santa Clara County, Sunnyvale. He plays the game, and then we ask him, what'd you think of it? And he says, oh, yeah, I know the guys who invented these things, you know. Oh, really? What are they like? And this guy proceeds to give us this whole bullshit line as though he's going to working for the date pickup line. So I didn't know what any of this meant, so I said, fine. So we waited, and we collected machine and money, and within about a week, the machine stopped working. And I got a call to go down and fix it, because it's a very, very crude wire wrap, very fragile. So I figured something clearly broke inside, and I opened the box up to give a free play so someone could play it while I fixed it, and the coins just gushed out. I go, well, this is a problem I can fix. So I filled my pockets full of quarters and said, hey, listen, when this happens again, you call me right up. And I told Nolan the next day, this thing seems to be doing pretty well. And then within another week, the bartender said, this is very strange. I mean, we have our drunks that show up and we open up at 9 o'clock, but all of a sudden people were at the door before they opened and they would come in and they just play this video game. And it was like, this is really strange. So it took off from there, and that's sort of how Pong happened. And by the way, I managed to keep possession of that first machine, so it almost still works, and I've still got that baby. And so that's sort of how Pong got done. So thank you.
That's awesome.
Any questions?
Oh yeah,
go back on the Wayback Machine to 1972. I've discovered this is something that is very common. People, I guess I'm 54 years old. People of a younger generation, many of you here in the audience, never lived in a time when there was not a microprocessor, right? So you can't actually build things without microprocessors. And so, yeah, their Intel had just come out with the 4004 and maybe a 1K Dynamic. None of these parts were of any use. They were very, very slow. And I don't think there were ROMs at that particular time. I don't think there were ROMs existed. So yeah, there was no RAM, no memory. It's a machine that, well, I gotta tell you, Nolan, God bless him, I love him. He gave me the schematics for Computer Space and said, here, you can use these, you'll figure it. I couldn't understand, he had never seen anybody write schematics in a more convoluted, if you've ever seen a schematic for Computer Space, he draws the picture of the chip, of the package, of the gate, of the pinouts, and then draws lines to connect them, not logic diagrams. Nobody does it this way. I couldn't figure out how the damn thing worked, so I just kind of conceptualized how it must have worked, and I built Pong, and it turns out it's pretty close to what he had in mind, but it worked. So yeah, it was just a hardwired machine that just did that, and that's, pretty simple.
That's awesome. One of the cool things about talking to you versus, you know, in this hobby, you know, there's stories that go around and that people hear fifth and sixth hand and see, you know, misprint in a fanzine and tell 20 of their friends. So it might be cool to get some of those stories cleared up. And one that I know that's always gone around is the famous story about when Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak made Breakout and just exactly how that went down.
All right. It's a little bit of a story. I'll tell the whole story. Atari grew very rapidly. It was really crazy. We were all so young. Again, we were expecting it to fail. Within the first year, we were up to $1 million in sales. We had no investment by banks or venture capital and that stuff. So it was all like, wow, this is fun. Let's see how far it goes. And it grew, and we finally ran out of space. We'd moved to Martin Street, and then we got this place on Winchester Boulevard near Lark Avenue, near Los Gatos, near the Santa Cruz Mountains. And up in the Bay Area, some of your wackiest people live up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and they come filter down out of the hills. And in those days, there were no consumer companies. And it was Silicon Valley was Lockheed, Ampex, Fairchild, Intel, and fruit cocktail packing, orchards and stuff like that. So we were growing pretty. We were making a lot of public stuff. Our games were very public. People knew about us. We had a visibility, and people would wanted to work at our place. So people would show up. That's how Harold Lee, who was very instrumental, just kind of showed up one day and said he'd work for me. And I go, well, why? And pretty good guy. Okay, work for me. And then so one day, Penny Chapler, the personnel lady, came in and said, I got this hippie in the lobby. I don't know. He seems pretty smart, but I should kick him out or what? I said, I'll talk to him. I got time. So he's this 18-year-old kid who dropped out of Reed College, and I said, excuse me, but is Reed an engineering college? No, it's a literary college. So you dropped out of a literary college and you want a job in electronics. Oh, yeah, but I got this buddy. I love electronics. I got this buddy, Steve Wozniak, and he's really good, and I really love to work here. This is a cool place. So, okay. Well, I had an engineer, Don Lang, that needed a technician, so I said, great. I go to work for Don. Don came back, said, my God, what have you done? This guy has body odor. He doesn't know anything about anything. And I says, well, work it out. He's a bright guy. So they worked out a plan where Steve would come in at night when his boss wasn't there, and Woz would do the work, it turned out. Woz would come in, and he'd play games on the production line. And Woz was a nice guy. He was fun. He would modify my HP calculator. And then Steve announced he was going to go to India to meet his guru. I said, great, right if you get work. It's a whole other story. I actually paid him. I paid his way to Germany to fix a problem with I got to tell that story. The Germans started complaining. We were shipping games now, video games, to overseas, to all these countries, and they were 50-cycle power. So our games were 60-cycle video. So they didn't do the circuitry right. They'd marry them in their own cabinet. We just send boards, kits. If they did the power supply right, it would be this hum. It'd be terrible because the interference of 60 cycles and 50 cycles was bad. And these guys, the Germans, wouldn't listen to me. They just, it's defective, you know. So I said, tell you what, Steve, I'll give you a one-way ticket to Germany if you'll spend a couple days and help these guys fix the problem, and I'll give you a half-hour course on how to do power supply grounding. So we did. That was great. The Germans, man. Here comes this guy off the plane, and this is in Bavaria, and we were talking about, he's a vegetarian, and the Bavaria's into meat, potatoes, and beer, and to make matter, and they're all wearing suits and ties, and he's wearing robes and barefoot. To make matters worse, he solves their problem. And they were, you know, I said, listen, any more problems, I got more guys just like him I can send, you know. So they didn't bother me anymore. About 3 months later, Steve came back. 4 months later, I couldn't believe it. He's now wearing saffron robe, shaved head, bare feet. I wish I had a camera. I wish I'd taken a picture. He wanted his job back, so okay. Now, part of the problem in those days was Nolan, wonderful guy, really one of the best entrepreneurs in the world, best creative game guy, but he has a very short attention span. So he would go in and he'd change the projects on the engineers. So I go in the lab and I go, what are you doing, Bob? And he says, oh, didn't you hear? Nolan told me not to do that other thing. And I go, listen, I signed the paychecks. You do what I tell you to do. So I had a pager system installed that when Nolan was in the lab, I'd get paged. And I'd come in and walk behind him. And the engineers would listen to him. And then I'd just say, you're doing what I'm telling you to do. And I told Nolan, look, would you just lay off? You know, it takes 9 months to do something like this. I know you get bored. You got a great idea. But just write him down on a piece of paper. I'll get to him later. So he got really frustrated. So behind my back, he goes and he grabs Jobs. Well, he didn't know that Jobs wasn't an engineer, couldn't do any of this stuff. And he describes this game, Breakout, to Steve. And he says, I'll give you $1,000 a chip for every chip under 50 that you do to get this thing done, describe the game. So I don't know about this. So it turns out Woz came in a few weeks later and in 2 days did this game. And he did the game Breakout in 20 ICs. He played by the strict rules. These were ICs. They were ICs from Hewlett-Packard. You couldn't get. They were bizarre things. Nobody could figure this thing out, but he did the job, and there was the game. It was. I think he actually had a RAM in there. He found a use of a RAM to keep. It was amazing. And I'm going, what the hell is this? So Nolan, okay. I said, Nolan, you realize we can't build this thing because normal techs can't figure it out. It turns out that we released the game a year later with 100 ICs. Sync generator, score counter, something normal people could fix and build. Meanwhile, Steve told Woz that he had a bonus of $100 a chip for every chip under and pocketed the money. Now, I sincerely believe that Steve was not living the high life and he used it to fund Apple. But nevertheless, after Apple goes public, there's this scene where Woz and his entourage are sitting in a jet flying first class across the country, and Woz is reading the draft of a book about, one of the first books about Apple, and the guy had done his research and found out the story, and he's, all of a sudden, Woz starts bawling, and he realizes that his best friend for life had lied to him, and that was the end of the relationship between Jobs and Woz because of that. Now, at the time, they were worth like, $100 million, but it was the point of lying. So that's how Breakout got designed, and that's how, and then I helped Woz. Oh yeah, if you want any business advice, at that time I was helping them get Apple started. They offered the Apple II product to Atari. We passed. My advice was there's no software. Who would buy one? You can't do anything with this thing. I helped him. I introduced him to Don Valentine. I got him to take parts. I loaned him my oscilloscope. I still have that design that we designed Pong with. He designed the Apple. Tim and Woz did the Apple II. And he was very appreciative, very nice, very thankful. And he says, Al, I want to give you stock in this company. I said, that company is going nowhere. I'll take a free computer. So I passed up on a percent or so of Apple. I got a, but I have an Apple II, an early one. Anyway, so if you want business advice, you know who to ask.
And you helped Waz do the video out on the Apple II, right?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting story. I think this is really important about how things really get invented. You may hear from other people too. It's not just like, wow, I'm so smart. I mean, I learned these cheap tricks when I was fixing televisions, vacuum tube televisions, so I knew how televisions really worked. And then at Ampex, I knew how to do other things. I learned how to synthesize video at Ampex for the sync generator project I was doing. And so that's really, from that experience and Nolan's understanding of how CoinOp worked, came video games. When, and in the true tradition of that, Waz was really into computers. He really just lived computers. But the problem, and in fact, I have an original copy of Byte Magazine, and then for the Altair, the ad for the Altair cost like $800, but the teletype was $1,200 or $1,300 for this KSR teletype, and people were hacking into key to typewriters, and you know, and so the idea of plugging the PC into a television set was radical, and the color, all that stuff was something that Waz learned working at Atari, how to do those cheap tricks with kind. If you ever look at an Apple II, how it does color, you know, it takes a twisted perception that I take credit for of how to do that, how to do the phase and not really consider it phase, and it's really awful stuff, but it works on most televisions, and that's how that happened, and I think it's a proud way it happened, and we loaned them parts and got them going, and so that's kind of a derivative, and I think it's a real good heritage of the technology.
Cool, cool. So that's there's some definitely some funny stories that came out of the Atari days, and I guess the one you sort of just mentioned to me before we started was talk to us a little about Jay Miner and his dog.
Mm. Well, I'll go back to the beginning. The all the stuff I've talked to you about so far really was the coin operated games. We got the idea to do consumer. I had this guy Harold Lee I'd mentioned. He showed up, and he was good because he could do custom chips. He knew how to do logic design and a whole bunch of things. He couldn't do chip testing, and through some circumstances, he said, "I think we can do." Pong, the original game now, this was like 1974 or late 73, and we can put that whole thing on a single piece of silicon, and I said, man, that would be cool. I don't know if we could sell them or not, but it sure beat doing, I got bored doing coin-op games, frankly. I mean, it was just, you know, it became a big management thing, and it wasn't exciting for me anymore. So Steve Bristow took over coin-op engineering, and Harold Lee, Bob Brown, and I went off and did Consumer Pong. And I have the wire wrap for that guy too. So, and that was fun, but that was the static logic end channel, very conservative. And when it came time to do the Atari VCS, the cartridge game, we needed a much better kind of technology. We needed depletion load, we needed dynamic logic, and Harold Lee said, I cannot do this. It's what you need, but I can't do it. I said, well, who can I get to do this? Well, the best guy in the valley is a guy named Jay Miner. Well, Jay was working at a company called Centertech, which was fortunately a company that I'd already worked with. They wanted to bid, they were building our Pong chips for us, and they did a very good job, and I'm still friends with those guys. The company's long gone, but in fact, I was just talking to Jack Bledo this morning. He's the VP of marketing there. And so I said, Jack, I want Jay to work for me. He said, no, you don't understand, Jay can't. He's busy doing the 6502 microprocessor that I got them. That's another story, because when Steve Mayer and the guys designed the VCS, the 6502 microprocessor was a key to it, and that's also the processor that was in the Apple II. When Joe Keenan, the president of Atari, found out that Jack Tramiel had bought MOS technology, that was now sole sourced to the microprocessor, Joe said, we're not being sole sourced, let alone to Jack Tramiel on this stuff. So think of something else. So I said, oh Christ. So I managed to get Centertech to be a second source. Okay, so Jay was working on that. So anyway, I get Jay to come over to work at Atari on the Stella chip, the chip that was in, that became the key chip for the VCS. And that worked out well, because I agreed to Centertech, they could build all the parts they wanted that Jay designed. So they were, okay, they agreed to do it. Jay was an employee at Centertech, but he was on loan to us, so he had two badges. And he got the thing to work. And he always had his dog, a cockapoo, Mitchie, his dog. He just loved this dog. And the dog would always be there at his feet when he was working. And that was really cool. All of a sudden now, by this time now, now we're up to 97. Atari was purchased by Warner Communications. We moved over to Borregas. We had a big engineering building. We had security. We're thousands of people. I no longer knew everybody by name. And I went over, checked things out in engineering, and poor Jay was very sad. And I said, what's the matter, Jay? What's happened? He says, they won't let me bring my dog in. Mitchie can't. I says, oh, that's no good. Why not? Security won't allow it. There's a rule against this. And I said, well, Jay, tell you what. You come to my office tomorrow morning, and you bring Mitchie, and you come to my office tomorrow morning, and we'll get it all fixed, okay? Oh, great. Thank you, Al. So he comes in with the dog, and we go down to security. I tell Nolan. I tell Joe. I just want to fix this. Sure. No problem. They knew how important Jay was. So we go to security, and we said, dog's getting a badge. Oh, no, he's not. Can't do that. Oh, yes, he can. Oh, yeah. We'll fire you if you don't. Okay. what number would you like? What's the number? I said, how about 000? Okay. So they gave Mitchie a badge, and Jay was happy.
Awesome.
And for those of you who don't know, Jay went on, he probably most of you know, he did the chip for the Amiga. And, yeah, great guy. He's passed away. But I'm one of the greats.
That's cool. Could you talk a little bit? We'll open up for questions after just this one last thing. But talk a little bit about just the Cosmos system and how that got started and how it sort of ended.
Boy, that was... what happened... Yeah. Oh, I'm getting a headache. Atari was a really great place to work. A Nolan's Atari. There was no politics. We were very open. We had a lot of fun. If you had a problem, you could admit it, and we'd all help out. There was no backstabbing or that stuff that went on. We were so open that it was spooky because we couldn't keep secrets to save our lives. One example was we all, after work, we'd go over to Khartoum's, this bar, and we'd have hoist a few. Pretty soon, our competitors and distributors would be there hoisting a few, and we'd be talking about our project. This was no good, so that was an excuse for Nolan to get a beer tapper in his office. Another trick we used to try to, instead of, we couldn't keep secrets, so we put out lies. So we let out, Nolan dreamed, and Nolan was real good at this, I gotta tell you. He dreamed up holography, that we're gonna use holography to make some new super game, try to get Bally and all the guys to go wasting time and energy on that. So that was always in the background, and we always bullshitted about that. After 77, when Ray Kassar took over, it was no fun for me to be in management anymore. I decided, by this time, Nolan had left, Joe Keehan had left, and I figured, well, if I'm going to stay here, I'm going to go back to my roots and do what I'm really good at doing, is inventing new things. So I thought, wouldn't it be a gas to actually do something in holography? And we agreed that what the market needed, the Atari VCS was now a pretty big hit, and it cost so much to build, and wouldn't it be neat to build a cartridge system, because they figured out the cartridges were good. We could sell those for a lot of money. Let's do something that has half the price structure, half the cost of the Atari VCS. Well, if you look inside of an Atari cartridge, all that's in it is one chip. So how do you save cost? You go to no chips. Well, okay, so we came with this idea of using holograms, and we'd worked on, now, at that time, in 1979, 1980, holograms were all very expensive. They were original works of, original images created by lasers in film and developed, and theoretically you could make embossed holograms, but nobody had done it yet in production, and I got a couple of holographers I found somehow, and we did it. We actually, it was there when the first embossed holograms were made on this press. So now we solved this problem. I remember reading in the Journal of Physics, IEEE Physics, imaging, auto-stereoscopic imaging. It said, basically, this can't be done. And I'd already done it. So I knew this was going to be fun. Now it's still a long way to make any money. Atari, by that time, had become so big and so afraid of its shadow. It was very weird, a very strange thing happened. And at first I blame it on the people, but I realize it's an organizational thing. It happens in any big company. When a company gets very successful, it forms an immune system around that successful product. I call it success disaster. And in one sense, you could sit back and say, gee, Atari could, in 1980, Atari could have released three or four failed products that wouldn't have hurt the company at all. They could afford to. Back when we were running it, we risked the life of the company every year releasing products, and we had fun doing it. But somehow, when it was a $1 billion company, oh my God, if we release a product and it fails, we can't stand the embarrassment. It's a very weird psychology. So anyway, they tried to stop the project, but we wouldn't. And we eventually made, there's a Cosmos in there, it's a rare one. Harry Jenkins, Roger Hector, and myself were the guys on that project, along with the holographer in the lab. And we actually hijacked the consumer show. We forced a booth to be built in the Atari space selling the product, and we had to sell it. No marketing guy would touch it. And we sold a bunch of them, we think. But Atari wouldn't build it. And that's basically when I left the company, because I could see it was a waste of time. They weren't going to build anything new. And indeed, Elephant 81, and by 83, nothing new was released. It was a shame. There were some brilliant people doing some really neat things, but they were just so afraid of releasing that all of a sudden, when Atari VCS did die, that was the end of Atari. So I knew it was dead, but it was making all this money. It was a weird, weird thing. So I left. They were happy to see me leave. They paid me not to show up. I had a company car not to show up in, and a bonus for not showing up real well. And I remember once at the end of all that, I had to get my money from the credit union. So I go into the credit union. This is Atari's, like, 10,000 people. And I go in the credit union, and I say, I want to get my money out. Okay, what's your employee number? I said, 3. And they go, well, 3 what? And they go, 003? No, you can't. And all of a sudden, like, my God, it is 3. How did you get that number? You know, it's a long time. You know, so gave me the check, and that's the last I saw of him.
Awesome. Thanks a lot. So I'm sure you've got a billion questions. Let's just go ahead and open it up and go until we run out of time.
Maybe not. Cool. No questions?
No questions. Oh. Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Okay, the question was how was the name Atari picked, and how did it come from Syzygy? The first name was Syzygy. If you look at the computer space out there, it'll say Syzygy Engineered, even though it was nothing associates. Syzygy was the partnership with Nolan Bushnell, Ted Dabney, and one other guy, the software, the programmer, who we didn't need because we had no computer to program with. And everything was fine until we actually formed a corporation and actually having sales and got to be something. And we realized, our attorneys told us, we could not use the name Syzygy because somebody else had already used it. It was already taken. So if you name things, you find that it's going to be a real pain because somebody else may have taken the name. So our next choice now, Syzygy, is a real word. It's the last S in the dictionary, and it's got 3 Y's. It's a great word in Hangman if you want to really screw somebody up. So Atari, Nolan loved Go, and Atari was just, it meant like a checkmate or check, and so that became the name. And my brother, God bless him, my elder brother, for must be 5 or 6 years thought I worked for a Japanese company, and I figured, okay, fair enough, it's a good story. So that's all it was.
So actually the Pong in the museum, there's a Pong board, and it says Syzygy.
Oh yeah, that's an E-Rev board. I looked at it, nice board. Yeah, Syzygy Engineer. We kind of kept that on, but we dropped it later. You know, just that's good. It's a good name.
Cool. Okay, right there.
What are you now doing for fun?
Oh, for fun? I'm working with startup companies. I'm working with an angel or two and helping some startup companies. And I also, I'm kind of retired, so I do digital photography, flying airplanes. In fact, Woz got me turned on to a really neat digital camera. Bill Atkinson is a great photographer, so a lot of fun with my friends playing with toys, cars, airplanes, and the companies. About one day a week I work with, I still love electronics and, technology, changing products. Since Atari, at Apple I was involved in creating the MPEG standard with Ivan Sutherland and Bob Sproul in the Media Lab. So I like to stir the pot up. I also did a slot machine company. There's a fact, in 1994 I started a company called Silicon Gaming, and there's actually five of those machines, or maybe more of them downstairs, Odyssey slot machines. The first interactive, it's got an Intel motherboard and touchscreen and a 4 gig hard drive and uses real cryptography and stuff like that. They're down there. The company eventually tanked, got bought by IGT, but so, you know. I like changing industry, stirring up the pot. There's nothing more fun. You should have been at the 77 Consumer Electronics Show in Chicago, and we introduced the Atari VCS. That was so cool because everybody was just like flabbergasted. We had the winner. It was clear, and National Semiconductor was trying to steal our stuff, and we wound up stealing most of their good engineers. And there was one of the guys. Reported to us that he was down at the national booth, and one of the marketing guys grabs Rick in. He says, "Rick, you got to get that prototype out of it. We got to show it. Atari's killing us with their VCS up there." And he says, "Hey, I quit. I'm working for Atari now. I'm sorry." You know, like, oh shit. Yeah, it was great. It felt so good. So if I can, I did that at the trade show for the slot machine trade show here in Vegas when we introduced in 1997 the. Odyssey, that was cool. We just blew away the industry. So
cool. I'm gonna take
some. Yeah,
over
get
here.
Some over there.
Right there. Yeah, you.
What are you feeling about games now?
Games now? What am I feeling? I don't know. I mean, now it's more like Hollywood movie production. So it's just different. You know, my reference to designing games is back when you were working on the metal. So it's just different. I don't. You know, I think it's the games. I'm disappointed they're in such a few narrow categories, and they're not that much diversity. I'd like to see more. And I personally, in fact, working with Jay Smith and I are kind of. I have a bizarre idea I can't talk about for some really truly interactive games, but they probably won't. I think they're too cool. But yeah, I mean, to me, it's putting $4 million down, it's too risky. It's not as much fun as having one guy just do a game when you could do that and get away with it. That's much more, if you get the whole thing in your head, that's more my style. I'm not that smart. I can't keep all that stuff in my head.
Way back there.
Oh, yeah, key games. Yeah. One of Nolan's good ideas was key games. One of his bad ideas was... He read a book somewhere that when a company gets to be $1 million in sales, you got to get rid of the management because you need a different kind of management to take it any further. That's a story most people don't know about. The Wakefield Mobilio and Oliver, he hired his wife's brother-in-law, who was a psychiatrist, to be the president. That was ugly. He hired a team of guys from HP that never worked in a startup company, had no idea about games or any of that stuff or innovation. To run manufacturing, finance, and marketing, and he hired a maintenance engineer from Ampex, Lloyd Worman, to run engineering. But anyway, the company was just about bankrupt at that point. So all of a sudden, what happened was Ron Gordon, international sales guy, said, "I'm losing my shirt on this," and he consoled Nolan. Nolan was actually in tears. The company was falling apart. And he got Key Games merged back in. I should say, why did we do Key Games in the first place? In the 70s, in every city in coin-op distribution, there were three major distributors based along the lines of the jukeboxes, Seberg, Williams, and Rockola. You could sell to one of those distributors in the city, and two others you were locked out of. Hence, we had so many competitors stealing our games. So this was driving us nuts. So no one came with the idea for the GE Hotpoint thing where you make your own competition. So we made our own brand name, Key Games. Joe Keenan was a neighbor of Nolan's. I gave them Steve Bristow as the engineering guy, and I had re-engineered the tank game, or not the tank game, excuse me, the driving game to work. It was done by Lloyd Worman's engineering. It didn't work. Anyway, they marketed it, and we all of a sudden had two-thirds of distribution, and that was why we did Key Games. And it was very successful. What really happened afterwards was when Atari was dying because of this weird idea Nolan had about firing all the old guys, he was able to merge Key Games back into Atari. We kept both distributors, so now we just doubled our distribution. It was now one company. Joe Keenan was just the right president to take us into the consumer stuff. So Nolan became the chairman of the board and the grand wizard of ideas. Joe was the real serious businessman president, but with a great sense of humor and a great attitude, we had just a great team, and that's when Atari really, then we roared, and that's, you know, and then the consumer stuff happened, and so that's sort of how Key Game, very, very, very important aspect of Atari's success. Well, the software, you just have to have some hardwired logic. Well, if you're talking about like the VCS? Well, that was a little early. I mean, now, I mean, this is evolution, a smooth evolution. I'll say from my perspective, when we had Consumer Pong as a chip, wow, that was great. Sears ran with it, made a lot of money. And then the next thing was a four-player, and then we had Stun Cycle. Now we're doing dedicated chips. This is very expensive, very time-consuming, and it was clear we needed to have a cartridge game system where we could have it as software, ROMs. And we were not the first. Channel Fairchild, Channel F was out there. There were a few others out there. I know Jerry Lawson. But we want to do a better job because all the other ones were being done by semiconductor companies and their interest was selling semiconductors. So we just, so Steve Mayer and Ron Milner designed the VCS prototype. It was brilliant. You know, it basically didn't have, we had, oh, I don't know, 128 bytes of memory, something like that. Not at all. No, in fact, no, it was really important because we knew the business model had to be there. The trick that we did, I think one of the, I think maybe the story I could tell is how, why the VCS was as good as it was. Again, we had Jay Miner, and it was designed in Grass Valley, and I took that Jolt prototype down, the WireWrap prototype, with the Jolt Kim board, 6502 development system. I put three guys together, Ron Milner, who was one of the designers, brought him down to the Bay Area, Jay Miner, who was the chip guy, and Larry Wagner, who was our first real programmer, mathematician. So I wanted, I said I want, because I had a wire wrap, so I wanted him to start writing the games, the production games for this wire wrap before the chip was done, because I just somehow sensed that that aspect of doing that will impact how the chip is being done, and especially with a small team. I remember sitting down with Jay Miner for like 2 hours describing how video worked. That was all I had to do. That was it, and he ran with it, you know. You got to figure it out. And because it was designed that way, it was so minimal, it was a lot more powerful than we ever planned it to do. It was only supposed to do Tank, Pong, a driving game, but we did chess. I mean, it was just, I many times Nolan and Joe would ask, can we do this? I'd no. And then the programmers would prove me a fool. And just to prove I was a fool, they would do it. And that was fun. It became a lot of fun. So, yeah, you talk about higher-level programming, really that, I mean, you know, that was later on. Apple really, that was really Apple's business. And there's a story about that, because Jobs was stealing a lot of my good people. And I didn't like this. And I told him to stop. Once I called up, I threatened to break his leg. He didn't believe me. I wouldn't do that. They wouldn't answer the phone, so one time I called up, for those of you who might know, and I couldn't get through to him. I said, tell him it's Al Alcorn from the FCC. Boom, he was on the phone. And he said, before he realized it, because he had some trouble with the FCC. He wouldn't stop doing it, so what we did, I couldn't, Joe and I, we went down to CoinOp and we told one of the engineers, we said, we're gonna knock off the Apple II. And we could outproduce those guys, and I didn't have to make a phone call. Within a week, I got a call from Jobs saying, okay, stop, I will not hire any more people, don't do it. We would have wiped them out. And the engineers weren't going to do it. I mean, I had these good engineers, they were going to copy a design, but I pushed it hard enough, long enough to get them to stop. So, but that was their territory, and you know, obviously now with the ubiquity, remember, we all you had in the home was a television set, a telephone, and a hi-fi. You didn't have a computer, per se, so it was as close as you could get.
Cool. Yeah, there.
Video music. Where's Bob? Are you here, Bob? Yeah, he's in the back. Video music, I mean, I think actually it's very important because you talk about, when people would interview me about, I work with the subject of creativity. I've actually worked with other companies to try to help groups become creative in a corporate setting. I think it's a very interesting study. I say to measure a group's creativity, let me see your failures. You've got to have failures, okay? We did Pong, and Pong was a big success. After that, the next product was this product, Video Music, that Bob and Harold, the two other guys that did the Pong chip, thought to be a great product to couple your stereo to your TV set. And we went ahead, made a custom chip, and Nolan never believed in market testing, focus group testing. He said, well, I can build a product, put it on the market faster, and I get much better data. So let's just build it. And remember I said the June CES in 77 was the introduction of the Atari VCS. The December, the winter CES of 76, the big introduction was Video Music. That was we didn't sell any of them. I mean, it was all the old guys that got one in the box in their and it widened. Yeah. Well, yeah, it was overbuilt. I mean, it was. I'm not sure. It was kind of a. Yeah, oh yeah, no, it was very pretty. It was maybe you made it cheaper, and by the way, I don't know if it would have worked. So we sold them. It was retail for $100-something. Nobody bought them. But you know what's important. Was nobody lost their job, nobody got fired, it was never criticized, and 6 months later we introduced something called the VCS. And that's so important, because when I was talking to Procter & Gamble, I said, let me see your failures as one group, and they said, oh, if you fail, you're out, your career is over. Well, I said, don't be creative, man. Bob, you want to say something?
Yeah.
Defend himself. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
The product itself was not successful, I think, in part because I got compromised in the product whereas the actual prototype
was
pretty good. But maybe
it's failing. Who knows? I mean, what I've learned is you can't really tell, but you got to try them, and the idea, the ability to go try a product, put it out there, even if it does fail, you'll learn from your failure. And you go on. And that's why Atari was great.
No one wanted to start it as a high-end product. That's why it was built that way. So they can always cheapen it up and lower the price. But of course, if the product failed, they
won't
do that.
Yeah.
Cool. I think we're just about out of time. Let's get one more question.
No idea at all. 2600, no. No idea. I wanted to stay out of that. I mean, you get into those arguments with the marketing guys, you get sucked into this black hole. No. I have no idea. Why they call it the video computer system made no sense to me either, but hey, it's sold.
Cool. I guess right. Maybe one more. Nope. Cool. But, okay,
pretty
good. Most spectacular failure. Wow, so many. In the context of Atari, I think again the VCS was great. I mean, it was a lot of effort, a lot of work, and it was great because it failed and no problem. I mean, everybody was fine. That was really great. After that, I don't know. We tend to forget them, you know. I had a lot. At Apple. They asked me to do Trojan Horse. They wanted me to do an Apple, a Macintosh plugin for an IBM PC, and we did. It worked, but they wouldn't market it. So anyway.
Cool. Well, thanks very much.
Okay.